Good morning. Please lower your voices. Thank you so much. Thank you all for being here today. I'm going to call this meeting to order. If I can, we can please have a roll call.
Mm-hmm. Aguilar, Alvarez, Arambula, Bragg.
Here.
Cole.
Here.
Gomez.
Here.
Hall.
Here.
McClellan.
Here.
McWhorter. Mullen,
here.
Rios,
here.
Roberts, Salas, Sankey,
here.
Zaff.
All right, hopefully other colleagues will join us throughout the meeting. If I could please get a motion for approval of the minutes, we appreciate it.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Sankey. Thank you, Mr. Hall.
Sorry,
all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Moves unanimously. We have one speaker. To speak to us during public comment, Lawrence Emerson. You will have 3 minutes, sir.
This is my second time to the meeting here. My name is Lawrence Emerson, retired Caltrans senior transportation engineer, and I also have very familiar with transit. And I lived in Tokyo, used the subways and trains. When I came to San Diego, I tested every which way I could to go to work and learned a lot. I appreciate what the board does. I think it's really important that we improve and keep improving the transit system, giving people options. On my way here from the trolley, I could see the freeways jammed packed on both sides, 805 and 5. So keep up the good work. I mentioned that it's good to get feedback when people make comments last time. I wanted to continue. My second item was getting more military people using transit. I live on the east end of National City by the, there's a Bayview housing. There's probably 1,000 families living there. And recently you reorganized and optimized the transit system and you moved the bus out from the center of their facility, and I really think, I'm asking some questions. I don't know what you did, how you did outreach to the military, but I think it's a real opportunity. I know some of them use motorcycles to go to work, and I often hear them having accidents. I met one who just had a child, a young child, and he had an accident on his motorcycle. So I'd like to see the transit options improved for them and do an outreach. So these are some questions. Did MTS contact the military commanders? Is there a tight program with the military to improve and get more of the military people using the transit? Are there any special discounts for active military? I mean, they're all congregated together. There must be a way to focus the effort and encourage them to use transit instead of them all driving through the community and onto their freeways. So what more can be done with military personnel to use transit? I just encourage, to get people to start using transit, they need encouragement. So somehow, I'm just suggesting that more outreach should be done with the military, get the commanders involved, maybe outreach at knock on doors in the Bayview housing, and I'm sure there's a way to get more of the military using the transit than they do currently. So that was my point I didn't get a chance to talk about last time. So. I'd like to hear if there's anything you do with the military. I'd be glad to work. I'm a member of the American Legion in National City. If you do outreach to the military, I'd work with you. And I can't stay for the whole meeting. I'm a member of also the American Society of Civil Engineers. I sent this document to Sharon. American Society of Civil Engineers have been a organization involved with infrastructure in the United States since 1851. And this document shows the last 5 years, more than 25 states have increased their gas taxes because there's a need to maintain the infrastructure. So that's related to one of the other items on your agenda. And this is just documentation that California is not the only one that raised the gas taxes. There's a real need to improve our transportation infrastructure. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. And staff will be following up with you. But thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. We do not have other public speakers for this item. Could I please get a motion for the consent item, or if there's any request to pull any of the items?
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. A second. Thank you, Mr. Werder. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Moves unanimously. So we are going to go into closed session. It's a short closed session for the public. So we'll take a break and we'll be back shortly. Thank you. So if we can all grab our seats, we're going to come back to our meeting, and our council will be reporting out from closed session.
So reporting out on item number 24, closed session conference with labor negotiators, the board received a report from negotiators.
Thank you. We can lower our voices. That would be great. Thank you. Moving on to discussion items, item 30, the revisions of policy number 18. I'll turn it over to staff.
So good morning. We're here today to approve a change or a revision to the board policy 18. We held an agenda item on this last week with a proposed draft that was really meant for discussion purposes. We had a lively discussion with all the board members participating. And so today what we have before you is there were no real substantive changes to the draft after the last meeting. Mostly they were just kind of tweaks in the language. But I did want to kind of highlight some of the things that are in this development program to help us to direct staff how to approach development proposals on their MTS-owned properties. So one of the things that we state in this policy is that we really need to prioritize transit operational needs. So in the event that we need a transit center, for instance, on our property, we need to make sure we retain enough land to be able to do that. And so there are some properties where we're going to have to do that in the future. We also indicate that we will analyze replacement parking needs at park and ride locations, that this would be engaged in any time we're removing any parking or if we're contemplating putting a development and possibly want to reduce parking due to lack of demand. We also indicate that we will be seeking improvements and other programs as part of the development that will have the end goal of increasing transit use. So these might be things like, does a location really warrant having a restroom for patrons? Is it a good possibility of maybe providing free passes as part of the development proposal? These kinds of things help to enhance the rider experience, and so they might be something that the board would have us consider on a case-by-case basis. We've also stated that joint development is expected to generate some kind of value for our investment. These are assets of the agency, and by gaining some value, whether it's through increased ridership or through financial consideration, then that's something that will always enhance our ability to maintain our system and to grow. Residential projects, according to this draft, will also be as dense as possible. We had a very lively discussion at the last board meeting about the fact that different locations will see different densities, and it's really a lot of times a market-driven thing and not necessarily just a policy issue. So we really need to work with the development community on those kinds of issues. The policy would also include 20% units set aside for affordable. And those would be according to the very low and low income categories of AMI. Full compliance would be expected on every proposal with local jurisdictional approval policies and procedures. So we want to be good community members. The local jurisdictions, the cities and the county would We would want to abide by what they want to see in their communities as well. The hybrid approach was discussed quite a bit by the board, and so we've incorporated that. That would be that we would seek proposals through competitive bidding, but consider unsolicited proposals after noticing their receipt for 30 days to see if there's other people who would like to come forward with proposals for development on the specific property. And then finally, this requires the staff to come forward to this board with a procedural manual within 3 months, which is certainly something we feel we can accomplish in that time frame. The procedural manual would be used as a tool to kind of indicate to the community of development and affordable housing and commercial property that this is what we're going to want to look for in a proposal. So that, and it would also outline how we competitively bid our properties if we do want to go out for a specific RFP. So with that, the recommendation is that the board approve and adopt the updated policy number 18, joint development program. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Sharon. We do have several speakers for this item. I'm going to call your name. If I can have you please get ready to address the board. Steve Russell, following Steve would be Colin Parent. And following Colin would be John Seymour.
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Stephen Russell. I'm the executive director of the San Diego Housing Federation. The mission of the Federation is to see that everyone in San Diego County has a safe and secure place to call home. And we're really pleased to be longtime partners with Circulate San Diego in advancing the issue that's before you today. We strongly support this initiative by MTS Chair Gomez to move MTS forward as a public agency partner to help address the crushing housing crisis here in the region. We need resources to help do this. The land that this agency has is available for that purpose. I would encourage you, when you think about generating value, that contributions of land below market to affordable housing developers actually counts as a local match and allows us to bring down additional state revenues. We can leverage the value that you put out there on the table. And with Propositions 1 and 2 on the ballot this November, the Veterans and Affordable Housing Act and the No Place Like Home Act, there are resources that will be available to us if we have the resources to match. So I'd urge you to support the propositions, of course, but this measure in front of you today would actually allow you to recognize what is generating value as perhaps what you're bringing down from the state level as well. Many thanks to the staff and Chair Gomez for strengthening the proposed changes from last time. We certainly support having at least a 20% inclusionary in this proposal. Maximizing density is key if we're going to realize the actual potential of our land in this region and meet our housing needs. And we think that aggressive, proactive marketing of opportunities for these properties is really critical to letting the development community compete actively for these sites and bring forward the best possible opportunities. So please, we appreciate your support of this, and I think it's a very progressive policy that you're proposing today. Thank you.
Thank you. Colin Parent.
Good morning. My name is Colin Parent. I'm the executive director and general counsel at Circulate San Diego. We authored a report that was published in April called Real Opportunity that identified that the agency here at MTS had a great deal of real estate that could be better utilized, and we're extremely pleased to have a policy before you all in such a short amount of time. This is a great accomplishment something that would not have happened without the terrific leadership from the Chair Gomez and from many of you here on the board making this a priority and directing staff to bring this back to you so that you could vote on this today. I also really want to recognize that staff here at MTS has done a lot of work doing this. I think Sharon and Tim, among others, have been very diligent in preparing this and bringing this forward. I think Kelvin on Georgette's staff also deserves a shout out for all of his effort on this. And I really want to suggest to everyone here that this is a real win-win, right? It's actually a win-win-win. So it's really great for affordability. You're taking public land that's underutilized. You're making it available for new housing and making sure that low-income people are able to live in that housing. It's great for the environment. A lot of jurisdictions have climate action plans now that require new developments near transit so that more people are able to get around without having to rely on a car. And it's also really important for economic development. There's nothing more fiscally responsible than using government assets effectively and to leverage new investment to make sure that what the public owns is being used effectively and to serve many people. So you have the opportunity to do all three of those things by adopting this policy today. So I really want to thank, again, Chair Gomez for making this happen, and really strongly want to encourage everyone on the board to take this vote today and to enjoy this win and to get this process started so that the agency can make that needed contribution to affordable homes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Seymour.
Good morning, Chair Gomez, MTS Board. John Seymour from the nonprofit National Community Renaissance. I've handed out a kind of colorful two-page letter today for the board members and asking the board to consider some additional tweakage language. It's not a big impact, but there are some where you should strongly consider adding this to the policies. We support the hybrid approach. I want to say that, number one. Okay, so page A1 and A2 under the policy, number one, where it says projects shall be considered that do not negatively impact present or future public transportation facilities. I would ask that you consider to add projects that demonstrate forward-thinking efforts to promote or enhance alternative modes of transportation in the foreseeable future that will be given extra credit consideration beyond tangible returns to MTS. On number three, where it talks about demonstrate a fiscal benefit to MTS, to add to the greatest extent possible, such fiscal impact analysis should include cost savings from reduced future modifications to accommodate foreseeable technological advancements and any revenue generation from activities and opportunities created from the joint use and development project, including but not limited to rental and leasing income, revenue sharing agreements, and advertisements. We added the term long-term economic development potential to MTS in the community. On the increased accessibility to public transportation, we added and alternative modes of transportation that reduce VMT and GHG. Again, more long-term thinking. On the exclusive negotiation agreement, we believe that if your project has at least 50% of the units on site as affordable, not the minimum 20, but if you go up to 50 at least, that should be rewarded, incentivized by not requiring the deposit or monthly fees to MTS until an executed development agreement occurs. Right now, the staff has it as an ENA. Once that ENA, then you make the deposit and make monthly and or monthly. We're asking if it's 50% or more, then you do that. The last one is, on the highest and possible density. We agree, but also make in there that it's economically feasible. Case in point, the Granville site, I think Kaiser Marston did different types of prototypes, and one had a negative land use value. Case in point, economically feasible. And lastly, number six, under policies on B-2, additional points would be awarded for proposals with a higher set aside of units for low and low income households as an incentive. Thank you.
Thank you. And that concludes the public speaker request. I'm going to open up to board members. Mr. Alvarez.
Thank you very much. And I want to start off by thanking Circulate for the report put out, I think it was earlier this year. I invite the members of the media that are here to jump on a trolley going south on the blue line or east on the orange line and look at the vacancy, the lots that exist, the opportunities to actually put housing along our transit system. I think that visual would be pretty impactful to the public. Anybody who takes the trolley system or who uses public transportation at core centers of our different modes of transportation will, I think, quickly realize that having a policy that creates housing along our transit is the smart thing for this agency to do. So thanks to Circulate. Thanks, Stephen, from Housing Federation. I have heard your comment multiple occasions, both here and at the city about the use of the value of the land to leverage and be more competitive for our funding. And so I just assume that that is something that will be kept in mind by staff, and I'll give you a chance to respond to that in my other comments and questions. But I think that's a good point that's made that we should keep in mind for sure. And to National Core and John, thank you for being here and presenting some thoughts. I'm intrigued by some of these, and maybe I'll refer to these at this point and ask staff to also respond. Number three in the proposed changes that he presents to us, I'm assuming when we produce a fiscal benefit or a report of fiscal impact, I guess, to MTS, we will include things like leasing income, revenue sharing agreement, advertisement as part of the fiscal benefit to MTS. Is that the case?
I just need to clarify that most of the comments that were in this letter refer to the old policy, not the one that's being proposed. So anything that's listed under A, page A1 or A2 is from attachment A. So those are actually not indicative of what we're proposing today.
Oh, attachment B is the new policies.
Correct. So okay. The comments on B can certainly, they're relevant to what we're discussing today. But with regard to a fiscal, we always look at things like ground leases, but we're also adding in to the policy now this other component, because so many studies have proven that affordable housing can benefit ridership for an agency. And so in recognition of that, we've added that in as a requirement for residential development, so that we can help capture some increased demand for transit,
right,
while at the same time we hope to get the best fiscal return on the investment as well.
So I'm looking at the new the attachment B with under section B of the policy, which I think refers to the financial implications to MTS the most in the new policy. I still think it's interesting to just somehow or somewhere, because I don't know where I would point to and say, well, this is where it covers potential financial benefits MTS with revenue sharing agreements or the things that are listed in the suggestions by this letter. Where does that fit from your perspective at this point?
Well, I think at this point I would include that in the procedural manual,
okay,
where we can kind of better define what we're looking for in an RFP or if we get an unsolicited proposal.
Okay, that makes sense to me. On the on the issue of sort of scoring, which was in the comment letter, the policies six, I'm assuming in the procedural manual you will also include this idea of points being awarded for higher affordability in terms of scoring criteria, or where would that fit?
If that's the board's direction, yes.
Okay.
If that's the interest, there are other policies throughout the United States, mostly in California, that do offer that kind of a point system, and we would certainly be looking at those as well. Sometimes you kind of need the people with the experience in affordable housing, the developers who develop affordable housing, to kind of tell you what a specific site can do and what kind of financing they can get.
Right.
So we're probably going to bring in a consultant to help us with the manual, and so we'll want to include some of that kind of feedback in there.
What about the issue about the exclusive negotiating agreement and the fees, the suggestion that they bring here, that we do not... If the affordability level is as high as 50% or more, that the proposer, the developer, would not have to begin paying the fees until an actual development agreement was signed. I don't know if this is the first time you hear of it. certainly is for me. So
no, we can certainly bring that back. The procedural manual will be approved by the board.
Okay.
And I think those are the kinds of things that will be discussed at that time.
Perfect. And then lastly, and I appreciate the hybrid approach, but you did say that it would be upon like public notice that that someone has submitted a specific site that 30 days from there it'd be open sort of for competition. Two things. First, are we going to, once the policy and then the procedures manual get completed, are we going to do a public announcement so that it at the beginning or at the front end, everybody is aware of this? And then second, if there's a specific site where someone has submitted a proposal, how will, given the Public Records Act sort of issues and as a public agency, the 30 days, I don't know that we want to publish what someone has put forward in order to protect that work product. I don't know how that goes together with the public records law in California.
Yeah, we'll include all of that in the procedural manual, but that's a good point that okay. we want to, you know, protect.
Right.
And okay. I would just comment on that. We will certainly confirm as we're developing it, but it is my general experience and understanding that we could simply say we have a proposal to develop this site, and so, you know, if anybody else has other proposals, but we would not release the proposal that had been received because that would technically still be under negotiations. And okay. under the Public Records Act, you're allowed to keep those confidential during the period of negotiations.
Okay. All right. Well, again, I appreciate the work done by staff and those who were here and spoke today with a lot of thought that went into this, and I appreciate the chair's work as well. I would move the staff recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Alvarez. Any other questions
sure,
from
I'll
the board?
I'll second that.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Mr. Sankey.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. My question involves the highest possible residential density. Now, no, my community doesn't have any parcels, so it's not specific to Coronado. However, each community has its own zoning standards and residential standards. And is it implied in this that the local standards will be adhered to? Is this an effort to override local control for density?
It is not an effort to override local control. That's what we did include language in there that said we would abide by the community's own policies and zoning and things like that. So it's not an effort. It's more to say, if possible, and financially, economically, through the various programs that maybe give you density bonuses, we'll want to explore all of those when we do development. Very much like we did with Granville, where we had Kaiser Marston do a study to tell us what is the highest use we could get there. And that really kind of indicates a lot about the economics of development today. So,
yeah, I certainly like the direction. I just make sure that we are mindful of local jurisdictions' needs as well.
And we're still open to, and this policy doesn't preclude us, going into an arrangement with a local jurisdiction, as we are considering with Chula Vista and El Cajon currently, where we would jointly develop properties with the city in mind.
Yeah, great. I love the opt-in approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sankey. Ms. Cole.
My understanding is that we've not identified property yet, the right-of-way property, or have we?
Yes, we have.
And so do we have that information?
I presented it at the last board meeting, but I could pull that up probably fairly easily right now.
It would be good for people to have it, as well as even the public, since they're here now. Yeah. Also, the outreach. You will be doing outreach to different planning groups, or have you started that, or will you?
Outreach for development?
Yeah, because some of our planning groups, they shy away from density, the word density. So I just want to make sure that we outreach to some of our planning groups to let them know what we're doing, because I think this is a great idea, but we just want everyone to be on board and support the development.
Did you want to speak to that?
Yeah, we definitely will be engaging individual planning groups for individual sites in different jurisdictions. It depends on where they are. Right now, it depends. In Chula Vista, there's certain criteria that we need to meet with their staff and get in the right direction. In El Cajon, they're already active in community outreach for the El Cajon Transit Center. We had 7-8 years of outreach at Grantville. So that's all part of it as far as requirements, and we definitely will be putting that into our procedures manual as well for procedures of moving through a process to make sure that the local jurisdictional community groups are engaged.
And Cantle Planning Group would be a great one to outreach to, if you would.
Yeah, right now the Encanto 62nd Street project is about ready to have a ribbon cutting. We're very proud of that project. The next project in that area hopefully will be the Euclid Station,
yes,
which the Jacobs Center for Neighborhood Innovation, I think if I got that right, is very active at that site.
You're talking about the Hilltop?
No, oh. not Hilltop. Okay. We don't own Hilltop. We own the Euclid Avenue Station, which is right there at the Jacobs Center. So
right,
we're very active with that group there as well. So those are part of our work that we
okay.
do.
Thank you.
So on the screen you have in front of you, these are we broke it out with the City of San Diego, since there's so many parcels in the City of San Diego. These are the properties. I'll mention to you that a lot of them have very active bus transit centers associated with them, as well as parking that is very much used on a daily basis. 12th and Imperial is right here next door. We purchased these properties some years ago in order to expand the transit center. You may have noticed that our buses are all over downstairs. We want to kind of consolidate them, build a transit center, and some kind of development above it. Those are just a few that I'm highlighting now. In East County, you see we have very large property at El Cajon Transit Center, which the City of El Cajon is very actively interested in helping that generate further development within the community. La Mesa, three different parcels, Lemon Grove, and Chula Vista, who again we've entered into or close to entering into an agreement with to jointly compete for those properties. That's it.
Thank you. Any other board members that wish to speak? Before calling, I'll just make a Ms. Aguilar, you'd like to? No? Okay. I felt like there was some comments brewing over here, so I don't want to ignore them. I just want to thank the public for being here and working with the board, working with my staff to really create a robust policy that I believe will get us development, will deliver more units, which I think we might see it differently, or we might have different perspectives in how we approach the importance of getting more units or who we're building for. But I think there's no question about it that the board recognizes the importance of what the rural MTS has in this whole conversation, and that's the reflection of the policy that is being before us. I'm excited that we can possibly get, that we will get development that will activate our transit corridors, but also address or be part of the housing crisis that we're facing in our region. So this is the reflection of that and what we're trying to do, not only just activate and hopefully get future riders in our system, but also be able to create housing for San Diegans that are definitely in need of. So thank you, and I really urge my colleagues to really support the policy. It is a good approach, and definitely look forward in bringing forward the procedure manual, which I think will be more expressive of how we're going to be approaching this whole thing. This is just a policy. Mr. Seymour, I hear you, and some of the suggestions, definitely very supportive, and I do see the possibility of inserting some of that direction in the manual. So we'll work on that, and what happens after the manual, I can guarantee you that we will be aggressive in ensuring that we notify developers that there's an opportunity in these particular lots that we currently have. So with that, I am going to call the vote. All those in favor, please.
I was just going to ask, there's a lot of parking out in El Cajon. There's a lot of parking being used. What will accommodate continuing ability for people to park their cars? Because out in East County, Santee, El Cajon, people have to drive a ways to get to the transit center, and then they want to use the transit center. If there's no place to park, well, we're going to be reducing traffic, not increasing it.
Right.
So we need to keep that in mind when we make a development plan with this and keep plenty of parking available for those people that drive in, use the transit, and come back, and then drive off. Because out in the sticks and everything, there isn't a lot of opportunity to park close by unless you use the parking lot.
Yeah, and I think the policy is written in such a way, but it's also written in the way that we want to identify good economically feasible density, but it also is mindful of parking. So there's more to be discussed in the manual that I think will be we'll have a better sense. But also even within that, as projects are coming in, there's more details, right? So there's a lot of what ifs, but this is just setting the tone. Thank you for that. So with that, I will call the vote now. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Moves unanimously. Thank you. So with that, we're going to move on to item number 31, which is the revised policy 30, which is investment policy. I'll turn it over to staff.
Good morning, Chairman Gomez, members of the MTS board. Today we are going to review the investment policy, do an update to that. That's investment policy is policy number 30. With me, I have Jeff Knipp from Milliman, who assisted us in the update of this investment policy. So first, just wanted to quickly go over what the purposes of an investment policy are, and it's really fiduciary responsibility to achieve three main goals. One, to safeguard MTS cash assets, to provide necessary liquidity so that we have cash on hand to make payments, and to generate a market return on asset given constraints of the policy. And that's really in the order in which we are to be fiduciaries. There are state requirements and regulations, primarily the California Government Code Section 53600.3, which is also called the Prudent Investor Standard. And it's a relatively long paragraph, but I took a couple pieces of it just to show. And it states, when investing, reinvesting, purchasing, acquiring, exchanging, selling, or managing public funds, a trustee shall act with care, skill, and prudence to safeguard the principal and maintain the liquidity needs of the agency. And then the investment policy is also a framework for the cash management process. And so we needed to update the policy. We wanted to do a complete review. We engaged the services of Milliman, who are investment consultants. They have significant experience, over 20 years of local experience in investment consulting and policy updates, including the City of San Diego defined contribution plans. And they've updated approximately 10 investment policies within the last 2 years. And so the goals here were to simplify and provide a streamlined approach to the language relative to the policy and implementation, to ensure that we're following best practices, and also to update state requirements and regulations as they tend to change over time. Not only did we have Milliman help assist us in the rewrite, we did an extensive review of this. Milliman included a professional peer review internally to review the investment policy. Our internal auditor reviewed the policy, and our external auditors reviewed the policy, and they were all pleased with the final result. So in terms of differentiation from our current policy, there's really no material changes in terms of oversight from our current policy. There's organization and language changes relative to the policy to make it easier to follow and comprehend, as well as achieve our policy goals of capital preservation, liquidity, and yield. We within the policy, we reference back to the California government code, so it's easy to trace back to the code. And we expanded language, provided greater clarity and guidance on risk tolerance, explaining what the risk types are, which risk types are controllable and which are market-driven, to detail the objectives of safety, liquidity, and yield, to expand on the authorized and suitable investments, including investment pools, which we are primarily invested in today, to provide safekeeping and controls, and and custody, and also to detail internal controls. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Jeff, and he can talk through the major elements of the policy.
Okay, thank you, and good morning. Before I start on this, let me just tell you a little bit about what we did. To do this work, as Larry said, we do a lot of investment policy work with our clients who are institutional investors. And in this case, we examined the investment policies of a number of other transit systems and districts around the state. We looked at some cities and counties. We looked at the East Bay Regional Parks District, which is actually my client in the East Bay where I'm from. And the whole idea was to get best practices. The California government code gives a broad framework for what's allowable, but each individual investor needs to think about what's appropriate for them. And as Larry said, the idea of safety and liquidity come first, and yield or return generation follows that. And so you want a policy that's consistent with those priorities. And also is realistic. And as Larry said, most of the investment is done through these pools, the county treasurer pool, there's a state treasurer pool. So the policy needs to reflect reality. So that's what we set out to do in doing this. The CFA Institute, CFA stands for Chartered Financial Analyst. That's a designation I have and a lot of my colleagues in this business have. The CFA Institute has suggested key elements of an investment policy, and there's really four parts to it. What's the purpose and the scope of the policy? What are the governance aspects? What are the investment objectives and guidelines? And how is investment risk being managed? So in the next few slides, I'll touch on each of those four, and I will point out where in this proposed policy those are addressed. I will say there's overlap. It's not like everything is addressed just in one section. But first, purpose and scope. So again, this references the government code, standard of prudence. You want to safeguard the principal, maintain the liquidity needs. Those are the two primary factors. And define the scope. In this case, we're talking about what's known as surplus funds, or you might also call operating cash. This is not pension assets, retirement plans, anything like that. This is just this operating cash. So all that's covered basically in the first couple of sections of the policy. Governance is an important part of it, and this is specifying responsibility for determining the policy and then implementing the policy. You want to address ethical issues, potential conflicts of interest, which you want to avoid. You want to set minimum standards for any service providers that you're going to be using. It could be investment managers, could be brokers, banks, anything like that. You want to have standards. Reporting. There needs to be a form of consistent reporting being done to make sure you're sticking with the policy. What kind of internal controls do you have to, again, make sure that the policy is being followed? And you need to have a process for reviewing the policy periodically. So all that's part of the governance aspect of this. And there's several sections in the policy that get to that. Investment objectives and guidelines. So again, what are the priorities? In order, safety, liquidity, and then yield or return. And the whole policy is set up according to those priorities. Larry mentioned risk tolerance. So there's really four key risks to think about here. One is credit risk, market risk, which is just being invested. In this case, it's in fixed income or bond instruments. Interest rate risk and custodial credit risk. That's banks. So the policy can really explicitly deal with the credit risk issues, both of individual securities and of banks. So you want to have minimum quality standards or the things you're investing in. The market risk and interest rate risk, you can't explicitly control. If you're going to be investing, you're subject to these risks. But you can help mitigate their impact through the policy. For example, by having a maximum length of the term of a bond, you can limit the impact of interest rate changes. So the policy is set up to address those risks. The code outlines acceptable and prohibited investments and puts constraints on some of those. In this case, we've taken that code and we've added some additional constraints, trying to be a little more conservative. Again, we think what's appropriate for this entity and this use of funds. And there's a table at the back of the policy that compares the code, which is the broad framework, the state code, with the policy. It's not overly restrictive, but it's got some limitations on how much of certain things you can invest in and the certain quality that can be invested in. And I will tell you that a lot of what we've done there really came out of our looking at these other policies from other entities, and especially the San Diego County Treasurer's Office, who has a pooled fund that is often utilized here. And they were very helpful, very open in explaining the rationale for their policies, why they are the way they are. We got a great benefit. We talked to them and went back with follow-up questions, and that was very helpful. And then finally, investment risk management, which is really thinking about what the return generation part of this. How much return is reasonable to expect? And we have to think about market environments and time periods. That this is more looking at market cycles over a full range of up and down markets. Don't worry too much about really short term. And think about what are appropriate goals. Are they some kind of absolute return or some kind of market benchmark? Are they an inflation plus some kind of number? You want to have appropriate goals set that can be reached. So that's really what the policy is about. And we spent, as I say, quite a bit of time looking at others and coming up with something that's appropriate for MTS.
And so I put up the staff recommendation that the San Diego MTS Board of Directors approve and adopt updated board policy number 30, which is attachment A. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Motion to approve.
Thank you. We have a motion, second by Mr. Sankey. Any questions or comments from the board? We do not have any public requests to speak on this item, by the way. Any comments from the board members? I see none. That is a reflection of a good presentation. Thank you, staff. And all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Moves unanimously. So moving on to item 30, which is asking the board to take a stance on opposing Proposition 6, item 32. Sharon?
Yes, this is a very quick item. I don't have a PowerPoint for you, but the item is to adopt the resolution that is attached to your item, attachment A, resolution number 1812, resolution in opposition of Proposition 6. Proposition 6 seeks to repeal SB 1, which was passed in 2017. Which provides a significant amount of revenue for transit services and capital projects throughout the state. Some of this is formula funding that will come directly to MTS in an average of $16 to $20 million a year. As well, we are also eligible and have received funding from this pot of money for various capital projects. Most recently, we received some funding for a BRT in the South Bay, as well as some electric buses and some additional service. So those are the types of projects that we would foresee in the future, that if we continue to have SB1, we would be able to initiate more of these expansion and capacity enhancing projects. It also allows us quite a bit of leeway to do state of good repair, which is always of keen interest here to the board. Things like replacing rail and buying new rail cars and things like that. So this is really a critical piece of infrastructure and service assistance to the transit operators in the state of California. And so our California Transit Association has asked member agencies to adopt a resolution in support to signal their commitment and then to forward that commitment for publication with the coalition to repeal, in opposition to Proposition 6. Thank you.
Thank you. And we do have several speakers for this item. You will have 2 minutes. And I will start with Tom Lemon, following Gretchen Newsom. And Colin Parent.
Tom Lemon, San Diego Building Trades, representing 35,000 union construction workers that build the infrastructure for San Diego County. I'm going to take a point of personal privilege and before I start and support staff's recommendation by thanking the chair, the vice chair, and council president Myrtle Cole for standing in solidarity with my brothers and sisters from Unite here, because one job should be enough. Thank you very much for that. When I got my first truck, it had disc brakes and had drum brakes and one taillight. Clearly, over time, my new truck has lots of safety features. Things improve. We need to continue to prove our transportation system. The gas tax puts money into that. I urge a support for a no on six. Staff's recommendation, you did a great job, Sharon, on your explanation of it. And I encourage a unanimous vote today. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Newsom.
Gretchen Newsom on behalf of IBEW 569, the Unionized Electricians of San Diego and Imperial Counties. So we are here today also in strong opposition to Prop 6. Prop 6 will eliminate funding for more than 6,500 local transportation improvement projects in California in every single one of our communities. Here in San Diego, the tip of the iceberg of what's at risk includes 103 projects improving safety of local roads and bridges, 314 projects filling potholes and repaving crumbling roads, and 20 safety improvement projects for pedestrians and cyclists. And as always, I like to tie policy back to jobs. Labor organizations throughout California and the California Chamber of Commerce oppose Prop 6 because it would eliminate 68,000 jobs and $183 billion in economic investments as thousands of road constructions are halted. Let's also talk about our families and our pocketbooks. The average California driver already spends $739 per year on car and tire repairs because we're driving on such bad roads. Stopping projects that fix our roads means more car repairs and more money out of our wallets. It's time to invest in our communities and make sure that our roads are repaired and that our bridges are safe and mass transit is built. As stewards of our transit system and for community safety, we ask that you please vote to oppose Prop 6. Thank you.
Mr. Parent.
Thank you very much. Colin Parent, Executive Director, General Counsel at Circulate San Diego. Circulate agrees that we need to vote no on Prop 6 and strongly encourage the agency to take that position. And there's a lot of important reasons. I mean, I think we just heard there's some really important economic development, jobs creating components to this measure. And if we don't vote no, we're going to miss out on those opportunities. But as you all, as transit agency board members, you all have a lot to gain from the continuation of these funds. If MTS wants to continue to improve its services, it's going to need these kinds of revenues. And then also, finally, as folks here know, I'm also a member of the City Council in La Mesa, and a no on six will help preserve the funding that we all get directly to our cities to be able to spend on transportation infrastructure. So a vote no on six is a vote to preserve funding to repair potholes, to improve safety facilities around schools, and I think that's just the most responsible thing in the world to vote no on six, and I would strongly encourage you to do so. And I'll just remind folks, too, you all have heard this, right, when you go door to door, People care about potholes. People want to see cities take efforts to repair those things. So if you vote no on 6, you're going to preserve your ability to do that and to directly address those constituencies, not just through transit, not just through your role here on the board, but also in your role as elected officials for cities. Thanks.
Thank you. Javier Santiso, I believe.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Javier Santiso. I'm with the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters. We represent over 65,000 carpenters. I want to talk on behalf of our carpenters and why we oppose Prop 6. San Diego citizens of this community, we're proud to live here. We're proud to work here. And we're proud of the bridges and roads that we build that everybody in this community enjoys. When family members come out of state, they fall in love with San Diego. San Diego is a beautiful city, and we owe it to our communities to keep it that way, to keep it safe for our loved ones that are on the road, for the tourists that come enjoy this beautiful weather, and so that we could give our children something to be proud of in the future, a beautiful San Diego. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe the next two speakers are Jorge Miramontes, and following Mr. Miramontes, Andrew Melling. Okay.
Good morning, board. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Jorge Miramontes. I also am with the Southwest Regional Council of Carpenters. Going to keep it simple. Prop 6. It keeps our members in our community safe and employed. By doing that, I believe it's going to stimulate our economy here in San Diego. Easy. No thinking about it. Let's keep our city beautiful. Thank you.
Good morning, all. You've probably heard, you know, this gas tax is currently funding various projects throughout the state and in our area here in San Diego. You've probably noticed, if you guys have been here for a while, traffic has gotten worse throughout the years. On a personal note, what used to take me 50 minutes to drive roughly to get to work is now taking me an hour and a half on a good day. I have no problem paying an extra $2.50 to fill up my truck's tank, you know, to try to avoid traffic, knowing that something's being done to fix it. And then also, you know, you've heard of all the jobs that this thing is creating. So I strongly urge you guys to vote no on Prop 6. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes our public speaker request for this item. We'll open it up for board members. Start with. Don't know, jump. Okay, Mr. Mullen.
I'll jump in first here. I don't think anybody questions the need to fund maintenance and repair and the kinds of things that SB1 funds. The struggle I have with this is whether or not this is the appropriate funding source. I have a hard time supporting the institution of new taxes when I believe that the money is available being spent elsewhere. I have a hard time supporting increasing taxes, and I'll give you the example when we're spending as much money as we do on the high-speed rail that is going to be a colossal failure. And it just seems to me that it's a much better plan, much less impact on the economy of California as a whole if we would just redirect money that I think is already available from the state towards this purpose. So I'm going to be voting no on the staff report. I recognize that it is that it's going to be symbolic, but nonetheless, I just feel like the money is available, and that if a little effort was made, it could be redirected from other sources for this superior use. In terms of whether the priorities, yes, it's a priority. I am Councilmember City of Poway, and we do not have potholes, and we don't because we make it a priority, and we find the money from the sources that we have to maintain our streets. And I think I'd like to see the state do the same thing.
Thank you, Mr. McLennan.
I would have to agree with that. This high-speed rail is a joke, and we need to use the money that they're appropriating for that in better areas. So they have money, but they just choose to spend it in the wrong ways, and that's probably the fault of our legislature. So remember that when you vote. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Guy.
First of all, I'd like to acknowledge all the work that our staff does. I really appreciate it, and I understand their concerns of growth. Now, I'm not trying to talk conspiracies or anything or be too negative, but most of you in this room are too young to remember when the lottery vote came up, because the state government said it's all going to go to our schools. It went to the schools, and they pulled back what they were already giving them, so the schools never made a net increase. I don't trust the state. I think there's options, which I've been told, that if emergency issues come, they can take the money that these taxes are bringing in and put it into the general fund. It's just an issue of not trusting, and that's why I'm going to vote no. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other? Mr. Alvarez, then Ms. Mona.
Okay.
Oh, Chairman, Vice Chair.
I will be supporting staff recommendation and committed to securing funding for this agency, but also for those riders in our communities. With the passing and approval of Proposition 6, it would repeal SB 1, and that would create a $16 to $20 million annually subsidy that would harm MTS. I also want to mention that in National City, where there is a large ridership of public transportation, folks who use it to go to work, to school, and back home again, this would devastate my community, and I will not jeopardize the services that they use by not supporting this. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hull.
I just take a different view. I don't think we should be voting yes or no on anything. It's really, in my opinion, people aren't going to go to the MTS site and look for how should I vote on six? The reality is it's just kind of really not our business to get involved in these things. I will be voting no, mainly for that reason that we did that a couple times in the city of Santee, and I really don't appreciate that either. And I've told them that when we bring up these issues, it's really not a good idea. I feel the money will be going to anything but roads, though. So similar to the Prop A, where they promised us $18 billion to go to roads. And then when we looked at East County, there was very little that came to East County. And 42% of Prop A went to the trolley.
Thank you for that. Ms. Seth.
thank you. Well, I echo the comments of some of my colleagues here, especially Mr. Mullen, Mr. McClellan. The way I see this tax, the way that it was structured, the way it came down, is very regressive. It is on the backs, disproportionately on the backs, of people, working families, low, fixed-income families. And it's going to keep going up. There's automatic escalators. There's going to be another increase in July. And it was not thought out in the right way. And also the money for that high-speed rail, that is not high speed, by the way, could have all been used for our roads and bridges and dams and so forth. So thank you.
Thank you. Mayor Salas.
Thank you very much. So the issue of the gas tax was highly debated with the introduction of Senate Bill 1. And certainly it was a discussion that happened way back in the day when I was a member of the state assembly. And the background of it, in actuality, is that our gas revenue taxes hadn't been raised in years and years and years, even though we had this failing infrastructure, deferred maintenance. So it's something that there was not the political courage or the political will to look at really what was happening with the funds that were diminishing in our state, especially with the inflation and all of that, that the gas tax was not being raised for many, many years. And in reality, that the gas tax was something that is unique to the state of California. Other states get their revenues by actually directly taxing the oil companies through an excise tax, which the state of California does not have. So it's a matter of apples and oranges when you're looking at funding sources at other states. personally, you know, all cities are different. And so for one city to say that we've got these funds to spend on our potholes does not acknowledge the different revenue streams that other cities have or don't have. So in the city of Chula Vista, we have a structural deficit because we don't have the appropriate amount of jobs housing balance. We have been the housing provider for much of the county, and so we pay a price for that and not having those revenue streams that come in. The city of Chula Vista, the city of San Diego, well, every city has benefited from this. If you look at very, very poor cities like Lemon Grove that are facing bankruptcy issues, this source of funding is really, really important for them to be able to provide those potholes, provide those services. So I think that we're sticking our heads in the sand when we realize that, you know, funding infrastructure costs, and how are you going to pay it? And what are the priorities that you're going to use to pay those things that really enhance our community? For a number of statements that were made here, good roads means less time on the road. Goods and services can move faster. It's good for the economy. And so I think that we have to look at the full complement of pros and cons on this. I think there's more pros than there are cons to this, and so I'll be supporting the staff's recommendation.
Thank you, Mayor Salas. Any other? Ms. Aguilar, and thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you, Chair Gomez. I want to say that I support staff's recommendation on this as well. And I must say that I agree with some of my colleagues' expressed concerns about how taxes are promoted for one thing and often used for another thing. I've seen it happen, and in general, I favor low taxes. But the gasoline tax, even though we call it a tax, it's in my way of thinking about the universe, it's not really a tax. It's really a fee. The people who use gasoline are the people who use the roads. So it seems to me that those people who are using the roads should help pay to keep the roads in good repair. Those who don't pay the tax and use public transit shouldn't be contributing to the repair of the road. So I see it as more of a fee than a tax in terms of, not legalistically, of course, but in terms of the way the thing works. So I'll be supporting staff's recommendation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Do not see any other colleagues. So let me just, before I call for the vote, I was the one that requested to be to put this item in the on our agenda for this month, because this is a significant, if this money were to go away, this is a significant hit to our budget. MTS budget. We can talk about cities, and we won't do that, because I really want to look at it from this lens of transit and what it means. I think Sharon did an amazing job in reflecting that. We get over $60 million to $20 million that is being used in our operations of transit. It's going to be supporting our BRT, the electrification pilot that we have will be launching next year. It's supporting the state of good repair of our system. Now, if this money were not to be there in the future, guess what, folks? The next conversation is about either cutting routes or increasing fares. And fares to the people that, remember, the people that are utilizing our system are the people that are not choice riders at the moment. These are people that are, we talk about underserved, the impact that this tax has on the underserved population. Well, these are the people that are utilizing our system. So if we were to increase the fares, they're going to get impacted even more. If we reduce the circulation of our transit, their routes are going to, they're going to have even a longer route to get to where they need to get to, which is their jobs. So if we care about underserved people, if we care about our riders, this is a huge impact on what it would mean if this money's not there. So because of that, I am I'm a strong supporter of opposing this proposition, and that's why I'm asking you, I'm urging you to please think about it from that lens, because this will impact our budget overall and what it means in terms of the next harder conversations that we would have. It is about either increasing fares, but also cutting some of these routes. So that's what's at stake. And that's why I think that we need to think about that, and we need to get out of our comfort and really serve who are we here to serve, which is our riders. So with that, I am going to call for the vote. All those in favor to take an opposition stance on Proposition 6, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? I'm going to do a hand just to be able to do that. So I'm going to call it again. All those in favor, please raise your hands. What is it? Nine. All those opposed? Okay. We are taking an official stance to oppose Proposition 6. Thank you. So moving forward, item 33, which is support for CNDX downtown stopover project.
So good morning again. Downtown layover. Last month at the board meeting, we did have a pretty thorough update on this project. This is, alternatively, Sandag refers to it as the stopover project. This is a project on behalf of MTS to provide us with a downtown off-street location where we can have our layover for our buses. The reason it's precipitated by Sandag instead of us was that they are the ones who are constructing the BRT facilities, and this is directly related to those BRT facilities because we're rapidly running out of room downtown for our rapid services. So I will just reiterate some of the reasons why we need a layover facility, and then the recommendation is to adopt the resolution in support of this project, which is attached in Attachment A. So we have more than 400 MTS buses that travel to the western side of downtown San Diego each day. If we go to full implementation of the regional plan, that number goes to 700 buses. We use 14 layover locations in the west end of downtown, and it's really dispersed pretty much on the west side, but in a few different locations, and I'm going to show you where those locations are. We do need layover for a functioning transit system. We use this to maintain schedule, to start a route on time rather than starting it early or late, and then we also use it to better manage the system and the network downtown. We also have a mandatory requirement to provide breaks for the drivers. Whenever there's numerous buses, as there are in downtown, we always like to have an off-street location for those buses. We've got these all over the county where we serve. We have them at Iris Transit Station. I mentioned earlier that we're going to try to build a bigger one down here next to 12th and Imperial. We have it up at the UTC Mall, which we recently had built for us by Westfield. So this is not an unusual thing, and downtown in particular is so constrained on the street that this is something we really need for the operation as the downtown area continues to grow and all of these blocks are being redeveloped. Whenever a block is redeveloped, we lose all sorts of curb space because now all of a sudden there's a garage, that entrance that people are using, and we can't put a bus in front of that garage entrance. We have a lot of residential coming into downtown, and residents don't really appreciate having large buses parked in front of their apartments or underneath their condominiums. So as it redevelops, we're going to need to have some place to put the buses while they do their necessary layover. So here's just a depiction of where we're currently laying over. And you can see with the little blue buses, that's where you see the layover locations. We've got three here. Anybody who takes this route on Front Street in the morning, you'll see it's very much impacted by the number of buses that we park along this curb. If you look at the little blue turquoise squares, those are portable toilets that we have to put out on the sidewalk. Not the best place to put them in a downtown environment, but we do have to have some facility, and we need to have those facilities during the entire service day. A lot of the buildings don't stay open during the entire service day. So that just gives you a sort of an idea about the kind of size of the problem that we're dealing with layover locations in downtown. Sandag has identified a block where this would be, and this was after an extensive study. This has been a project that's been in the works since 2009. We've looked at many, many locations. I personally have walked downtown many, many times to try to figure out what we can do for a better location, but this one really is ideal for the operation as well as for sort of the other uses that are surrounding it. And this is a property that we support at the staff level for Sandag to attempt to locate this stopover. So today's action would adopt the resolution number 1813 in support of Sandag's downtown stopover project. And this resolution also expresses the board's commitment to making sure the project is fully implemented. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Sharon. Open up for questions. Mr. Sankey.
So one of the things that troubles me about this project is so undefined at this point. There are parcels that are still in litigation or we're having trouble obtaining. I say we, wearing two hats, I serve on the Sandag Transportation Committee. There's disagreement as to what should go on top of this stopover facility, office spaces for Sandag, possible low-income housing or market-rate housing. This thing is really in flux, and even the Sandag board is having difficulty wrapping its arms around it. I think this might be a little premature, personally, and I'd have trouble supporting it today. But, Sharon, if you wouldn't mind commenting a little bit on the status of the project as a whole and help us understand as a body more what we would be supporting if, in fact, we did support it.
Well, I can tell you that it's been thoroughly analyzed for this site, and staff and MTS has been participating with that analysis throughout the process. From a staff perspective, we do recommend that this is the site we would choose if this was an MTS project. From the perspective of where it is now, Richard Chavez is here. He's the project manager, and I would rather he speak to that.
So in June, the Sandag board looked at five different options for use of the site, ranging from using it for stopover only all the way to full build with housing and office and other multi-use, which is favored by the downtown community. We spent a lot of time outreaching to the downtown community, and one of the things that's consistent is they'd like to see the property used to its highest and best use, not just parking buses on it. In order for us to get a multi-use facility on the property, we need space for things like elevator landings and loading docks and parking ramps to get underground parking in. But in June, the board directed us to buy the property from the two willing sellers, which will allow us to develop an interim facility to get six buses on the site. Ultimately, we need parking for 18 buses simultaneously downtown. Sharon mentioned earlier, with the implementation of the regional plan, we expect over 700 buses to be coming downtown to Western downtown every day. So the direction was to buy those two properties and continue negotiation with the remaining three property owners, which we continue to do.
And if you wouldn't mind helping me, in terms of the highest and best use and that sort of thing, did the Sandag board at the June meeting express any interest in kind of coming down on one combination of additional uses above the parking?
No, there was no decision on which of the five alternatives to select. But for each of the five, we do need the entire block or the vast majority of it.
Thank you for that. Any other questions? Ms. Bragg.
Thank you. I remain excited about this project. We've been looking at it since 2009, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in staying the course on this project. It's full of opportunities for us. So, and when we had it at our last meeting, I was even more excited. And I think if we look at our resolution in support of, if you look at the fourth whereas, it really just encapsulates everything that's wonderful about this project. So I'm hoping that we remain in full support of this project. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Ms. Roberts. Oh. Your light's on, sir.
I got it. Okay.
No?
Yes.
Okay.
No, Lori nailed it. I don't know if I need to add. We don't have a solution other than this. You've got buses parked all over San Diego. Many of them are red zones. We've got temporary bathrooms out on the streets. We've got an untenable situation. If you're against this, then tell me what you're for, because we've worked very hard to try to find a site. This is the site. There's no question about it. Hopefully in time, if they can acquire the whole site, that would be the best answer, because you've got to pay premium for the site based on the fair market value of the property. And in doing that, it anticipates that the fair market value is something that's going to go up multi-story. So you're going to be paying to pay just to put buses out there and not do anything subsequently with the property would be a very bad business deal. I don't think we're in a position right now to know what is going to, how much of the property ultimately is going to be available and what can be done. But you would hope that Sandag would maximize the value, the money that's being put in will maximize the value to Sandag, to MTS, and to maybe anybody else. That's what's under this. And, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to do this. This is the right thing to do, because there is no other solution that I'm aware of.
I appreciate that. Mr. Hall.
Well, I would assume that was a motion.
I'd be glad to make the motion. Thank you.
And I'll second it.
Thank you. We have a motion on the floor. Second by Mr. Hall. Any other comments? All right. Well, I really appreciate the comments and the questions that were asked. I do believe that this is a project to continue moving forward, and I am as excited as Ms. Bragg. Thank you for expressing that. I think this is a project that really serves, I think I said it last month, it's a project that it serves every single region. All the buses that are coming from the south, that are coming from the north, and that are even coming from the east are all coming into downtown. And we definitely are getting a lot of complaints from the downtown constituents that buses are impacting the quality of life overall, because we don't have a place for them to go. So yes, they're in the streets. Our bus drivers do not have healthy conditions in terms of having the necessary utilities to serve them properly. So this is the intention of all of that. So I'm a strong supporter, and I would urge my colleagues to support this this project that has been in the mix for many years. So with that, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Moves unanimously. Thank you.
Chair Gomez, I'd like to go back to item number 32, the resolution that passed on the Prop 6. We didn't note for the record the second. I believe that Vice Chair Rios may have intended to second that, but I just would like to be able to clarify while you're all here if we can note that in the record.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. So moving on to report items number 45, which is the first transit taxicab pilot. How are we doing with that pilot?
Good morning, Chair Gomez and members of the Board of Directors. I'm joined this morning by Jay Washburn, who is our manager of the Access Paratransit Program and our minibus operations. This morning, we wanted to give you an update on our taxi pilot program. We'll start with a quick overview of that pilot program, some of the components of it, how it actually operates. We've been doing it for 3 months now, and so then we'll roll out some results and share those with you. The pilot program was really developed as part of our overall program to continue to make sure that we maintain service quality on the access side, but that we also continue to look for cost-effective and cost-efficiency programs. And we realize that there is a there's an abundance of taxi resources available in San Diego now, and so we wanted to leverage those taxi resources and see if we could pair that with targeted access customer trips where that makes sense. So our goals for the program were, in line with that, were to decrease the cost per trip and drive cost effectiveness, but also maintain service quality, because that's important as well. So we began to focus on, are there access trips that would be most advantageous to move to taxi? And those typically are the single customer trips. So we have a lot of access trips where we only have one customer on the vehicle at a time. They're ambulatory customers who don't need additional assistance from the driver. And those tend to be the highest cost, least productive trips on the access system. This entire pilot program is managed and administered by First Transit, so it's all within our contract with First Transit for the Access Paratransit System, and they've in turn subcontracted with Yellow Taxi Group. So that provides us the oversight of not only the First Transit management team, but also the access management team as well. And all of the taxi trips are required to be ADA compliant, and because we're doing it within our First Transit contract, we have all of that oversight and all of those service requirements. So in terms of reservations and scheduling, the vehicles, the drivers, the service quality, everything has to meet the ADA requirements of the access system. So it's a 12-month pilot. We set a target of 36,000 access trips to move to taxi during that pilot program. And then we began the pilot July 1st. And so we've concluded our first quarter. And that'll run through June of 19. It utilizes the exact same reservations process. So when an access customer calls in, they make their reservation. They don't even know until the day of service that a taxi may show up for their trip as opposed to an access vehicle. We've added Trapeze Trip Broker software. If you recall, back in the fall, we brought that to you. And that software really is a dynamic piece that really helps First Transit and our access staff make this work. It's constantly looking at the access trips to see which ones make sense right up through the day of service in terms of meeting all of the scheduling factors. And those are the customer data, the trip distance, the locations of the trip origin and destination, compatibility with other scheduled trips, because what we don't want to do is take apart a trip that made a lot of sense on access and pull those trips away, and then that becomes an unproductive trip. And then finally, the estimated total cost of trip is also a component of that. And of course, all of that is, as I said, managed and monitored on a detailed basis by Jay and his access team, as well as the First Transit team. One more additional piece that's important is we've incorporated the Community Transportation Association of America Passenger Assistance Safety and Sensitivity Driver Certification Program, and that's a lot of words. But essentially, that is a national driver certification and training program that was developed by one of APTA's sister agencies, really for these kinds of programs. And so it's a national program that you can bring in and certify drivers, and it includes all of the components that you see listed there. And so far we have 165 of Yellow Taxi Group's drivers certified in the program and able to operate those trips during this first quarter, and we continue to add additional drivers. It's voluntary on those drivers' part, so they have to let Yellow Taxi know that they're interested, and then they have to go through this certification program before they can operate a trip for access. So as I said, we've been at it for 3 months. Here's how we're doing against those goals that we set. Reduced costs was one of them, because we're trying to take those really high cost, low productivity trips and put those on taxi. We've been able to achieve our first quarter goal, which was 9,000 trips, and we're a little bit above that. And we were also able to move a little bit longer trips than what we'd originally estimated. We were expecting to move the average trip of 8 miles. We're actually up around 10 or 11 miles in terms of trip length. So we're able to drive a little bit more savings on a per trip basis as well. The other piece that's very important to us is continuing to maintain service quality and productivity on the entire access system. And we've been able to do that. On-time performance, as you see, has improved by 4%. And average trip travel time has been reduced by 15%. And not necessarily all related to the taxi system, but we're happy to say that safety has also improved in terms of preventable accidents. And I've included the specific information on the taxi service. We've had one minor accident, which was a passenger vehicle bump in the back of a taxi, and then we've not had any preventable accidents on the taxi trips. Customer feedback is important. That's an important way to measure the success for our access customers. I've included the numbers from our customer service system. We've received 43 customer service complaints in those 3 months on those 9,000 trips. So that's a ratio of a little less than 1% on the total trips. All of those customer service complaints come through our system, just like all of our trolley, bus, security, any complaint that a customer would have on any part of our MTS business comes through that customer service system. So the taxi complaints are being managed identical, mirroring the same system in terms of reporting, investigation, and resolution. I've included that driver attitude is the highest complaint category so far. And First Transit and Yellow Taxi Group, they get all of those complaints, and they're proactively dealing with those with the drivers. They do everything from driver retraining, more detailed monitoring those drivers, and they can remove a driver from the program, and that's happened as a result of complaints. We also have received 11 customer service compliments through our customer service system. Those are just where a customer came back from a taxi trip and wanted to call in and let us know that it went well, and you've got that in your slide system. We were happy about that. We've also started doing surveying by Jay and his team, so they're going to begin to go through access customers who have taken taxi trips. We've just started that process. We've completed 40 surveys so far, and those results are tracking, we believe, what we're seeing on the customer service system, and that is that the taxis are on time. 98% did indicate that the driver was courteous and professional, and 95% indicated that the taxi was clean. We did receive some suggested improvements. We asked if there's something we could do better. Three of the areas that we're working on is a few taxis reported as having odors. We're following up on those. Improve the customer notification process. That has to do typically with access customers being more proactive in keeping their own file up to date in the system and making sure that we have current cell phone numbers so that we can contact them as the driver is arriving. And then taxis are not large enough, which, as we all know, in San Diego, Prius is the taxi that gets used, and we've had some customers point out that that's difficult to get in and out of. So that's our program so far. The first 3 months have been successful in terms of meeting our goals. The program is successful so far, and we will keep you updated as that goes along. And if there are any questions.
Thank you, Bill, for that report. Any questions or comments from my colleagues? Yes, Mr. Mullen.
I'm looking at the savings chart. And I can see that the savings per trip is $25.79. But do we know what the total access cost is? That total trip? Yeah.
Yeah, the calculation on the access trip is?
It varies depending on the distance.
Turn your microphone.
It varies on the distance because of the time allotment. So, but in comparison to the taxi trips, it's in the $58, $56 range for a single ride passenger on an access bus.
Okay. All right, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. McClellan.
Yes, I was just wondering if some of these people that are able to get in and out of a taxi, if they still actually need the access system, or how close we're, some people may have gotten it and don't need it anymore, and we need to check and make sure that they're still able to have that because of the high cost for us.
Bill, maybe you could talk a little bit about our certification process.
Yeah, we, as part of that overall review process and improving access, as you recall, about 2 years ago, we changed out our contractor who was doing our certification process, and we brought in a company called MTM, a national provider. And they've been going through, we're about two-thirds of the way or more for recertification, because all customers have to be recertified every 3 years, and then they also do the new certifications. What you will find on the taxi trips is those are primarily access customers with either cognitive disabilities that prohibit them from being able to figure out how to navigate the system, because it may require transfers and catching different bus routes or trolley lines, or people who have who are unable to navigate physically from their home to the bus stop or the trolley line.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions?
If I may, thank you. Mm-hmm. As chair of our accessibilities committee, this we were really excited with this pilot program. And Jay and I were at our very last committee meeting. One of our board members, our committee members, stated that if you're a user and you happen to get a taxi come to your home to pick you up, that they feel like they've won the lottery. That it's just an incredible experience for them. And I really did want to kind of focus in on page 7. Those three performance measures that we're looking at, the on-time performance for this particular demographic, that is really key. And then the average trip time, the reduction by 15%, that really makes a huge difference in this particular demographic in their day. So we did hear that one of the issues that we're trying to work on, it goes back to the size of the car and the driver training, is folding up maybe the walker, and so there's lessons that we're learning, but I remain very hopeful with this project. Jay, I really wanted to thank you and your staff for this. It's made a huge transformational difference in their lives. Thank you.
Well stated, Ms. Bragg. So thank you so much, and thank you for the report. Really appreciate it. Is there somebody else? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Have we canvassed the other users that maybe aren't using it now to see, would this be more beneficial to you to use a taxi than the access vehicle? And maybe we could get more people to use it rather than the access vehicle. Because if the access people are actually the ones arranging the trips, I wonder if everybody that doesn't need an access vehicle is being shifted off to the taxi program. Because if I was in business with access, I wouldn't want to lose these customers to taxis. But, you know, we need to do kind of a finding out how many people actually could be using it that aren't using it, mm-hmm. for taxis, I mean.
Well, that's the intention of a pilot, right? We're learning, yes, what works, what can be improved, and what happens after the pilot is to be continued. So, right?
Yes. And one of the things that we've done that's a little different than the way that taxis have been used in other paratransit systems around the country, because you can Google and you'll find that there are systems that have tried taxis and they've been failures, and there are systems that use taxis and it's successful. And the places where it's most successful are the way that we're doing it, where the customers are not making the decision about whether they use the paratransit or they use the taxi. It's the system that makes the decision, which is most beneficial to both the access system and to the taxi system. So that, with that approach, so when customers call in, they can't call in and say, don't send me an access vehicle, send me a taxi. It's the decision of the system based upon those business parameters.
Thank you for that. So I see no other comments or questions. Thank you for the report. Thank you for the great work. Moving forward with the report on Comic-Con. Seems like that happened a long time ago.
I'm very lucky to be the marketing director here, because I get to do all the fun stuff. You know, you guys listened to some pretty heady presentations this morning, but Tom and I are going to talk about the results of Comic-Con. If I can get that going. So brief summary, Comic-Con, as you all know, real exciting time of the year. Downtown comes alive, ads all over the place, and we're right at the epicenter of it all. This is a look at our gas lamp quarter station. A quick summary of this year's event. We had 381,000 extra rides. We had 40 trolley wraps, which is a new record. Our fare revenue was an additional $581,000, and our ad revenue was almost $500,000. Trolley wraps continue to be a real popular vehicle, no pun intended, I suppose, for primarily TV stations to promote their new shows. I mean, they really embrace this. ABC had 9 wraps, Fox had 15, TBS had 9. There were 3 sci-fi, and then there was some one-offs on that too. So again, we've got more capacity. Hopefully, our advertiser's goal is to get 48 wraps next year. So we'll see how that goes. NBC activates our gas lamp quarter station every year, and then the marketing team comes up with various ideas to activate stations and to get more viral interest in the program. So we did a Stranger Things wrap down at the convention center. That's what you see there on the right-hand side. Ticketing, of course, we want to get all that fare revenue. We put together ticket packages for commemorative pick tickets. We took a kind of a more pop art approach this year rather than a sci-fi approach. So those were our printed tickets there on the right. Continue to push mobile ticketing as a solution. This is the crowd that will really adopt mobile ticketing. So our revenue there was about $90,000. That's up 19% from last year, and it represents about 15% of all the tickets that we sold. And then, you know, we have a lot of advertising out there. We do advertising at the airport. We now have monitors at our ticket vending machines, so we're capturing people as they come into town. We've got point of purchase ads, print ads, and we do a lot of social marketing. This is kind of the result of what you gain by doing something a little bit innovative. You know, the people that come to Comic-Con just love this, the kind of effort you put into activating a station. This is the Stranger Things activation again. We had a news conference down there, but the real value in this is people take pictures in front of this and they push it out on social media. And so if you see all of these posts that were made, and this is not a complete list, this is the top 10, but there's, you know, 400,000 extra people sent out by organizations that support Comic-Con. So that's a way we really work to increase our reach. And now Tom's gonna get into some more nitty gritty.
Good morning. Comic-Con obviously has grown, our involvement has grown over the years, and it continues to grow, and we look for ways to increase efficiency, increase safety, and increase the customer experience. Some of the changes for this year outside of our operations, but we were involved with the security and safety adjustments. These are photos of Fifth Avenue, the crossing there across from the convention center leading into the gas lamp quarter. And the street is closed for pedestrians, but they've added some police vehicles as well as barriers to keep any inadvertent vehicles from driving into that area that's typically crowded with pedestrians. Also, the Harbor Drive area in front of the convention center was closed to vehicle traffic this year. That was in order to provide a larger and safer space for pedestrians. It was open, they moved the shuttle bus operations down to Harbor Drive, and that left the front of the convention center driveway open for pedestrians as well. Thank you. We see the pedestrian flow and customer flow in 3 different key locations at our stations, at the grade crossings, specifically in front of the convention center, and also on board the trains. At the stations and at the grade crossings, we have personnel that are helping passengers to safely cross the tracks, to safely board, and alight from trains, as well as if they haven't purchased tickets, we have people that are selling tickets. We also have people that are helping at the ticket vending machines, all in an effort to make the system flow as efficiently and smoothly and comfortably as possible. Now, on board the trains, you can see a shot there in the top right corner. That's on board a train. There's a one of our vehicle maintenance workers there that's on his way to a post. We staff some of our outer areas with response teams because we're running crush load trains at 7-minute intervals. And even a 5-minute delay due to a door problem or something that can't be resolved immediately by the train operator means that that train is falling almost a full headway down, and that almost doubles, just a 5-minute delay will almost double the impact, the ridership impact on an already crush loaded train. So we want to make sure that rider experience on board the trains is as seamless and smooth as possible because, as I said, the intensity of the event just magnifies any potential problems. And when you're dealing with the heavy loads, the number one most common issue we can have are people that stand in the doorways inadvertently not realizing they're not allowing the train to depart. So just having somebody there on the platform that can ask them to step inside using the public address system on board the trains and all helps keep those trains moving along. The Gaslamp Quarter Station is obviously key, and it's a very focal point because of the Fifth Avenue crossing, the proximity to the Gaslamp Quarter, the off-site events that are held in that portion of downtown, Petco Park, and the Convention Center. But the Convention Center station itself, which is the station as riders are coming in on the Green Line that they hit first, is kind of off the radar for some of us. But it's actually, especially in the morning hours, a very, very key player. This is a time-condensed video of, this is on Thursday morning, which is one of our lighter mornings, about mid-morning. And this is these are trains that are coming in from the Mission Valley area, and you can see the number of passengers that are getting off. And our normal riders are still riding our trains, going to and from work and to and from the doctors and all this stuff. So we're not only dealing with all these folks going to the convention, but we're providing service to our regular riders, and we don't want to lose them in the excitement of this major event that's going on. As you can see, sometimes we're barely getting the platform clear before the next train pulls in and dumps off an immense number of people, and to see this in person is really quite amazing. And it takes the effort of everybody involved at 110% for this to even occur. Our automated passenger counters that are located on our trains that provide us some great detail as far as the boardings and alightings on our cars. You can see here that the Green Line, obviously the proximity to the Convention Center stations, carries the lion's share of the loads. Saturday in particular, these are just the event ridership numbers above our normal ridership day, 126,000, almost 127,000 boardings were recorded on that Saturday. That's up 12% over last year. Overall, as Rob mentioned, ridership was at a record 381,000. That's up 5% overall from last year. And every day saw an increase, except for Friday was a little bit lower than last year, but certainly not by much. And this is a visual representation of how the ridership is divided by line. And you can look at the Green Line is just immense at 79,000 riders, additional riders on the Green Line on Saturday, over 50,000 on the other major days, Thursday through Sunday, going through. That to put it in perspective, that 79,000 additional boardings, that's equivalent to two of our 2003 Super Bowls. And if anybody was around during those times, you remember what an intense time that was for us. We did that two times over on that Saturday. And all those passengers are going to basically three stations, downstairs here, 12th and Imperial, Gaslamp Quarter, and Convention Center stations. The overall ridership by line on, if you include our regular riders in there, that's we're over 100,000 on Saturday on the Green Line, 91,000 additional on the Green Line on Friday, and certainly very significant numbers on the other two lines as well. And if you look at the system ridership by day, the blue there represents control dates that were non-event dates that we looked at earlier in the month compared to Comic-Con, and we went from 78,000 on a normal Saturday to 2.5 times that amount to over 200,000 on the Saturday of Comic-Con. Fare revenue was down 3.6% from 2017. Part of that is we're seeing more people use the multi-day passes, making multiple trips on their day passes. And also there's just some variances because we're using control dates to set the baseline, and sometimes the control dates year over year have some variances as well. Rob mentioned the Compass Cloud. Overall, we were up 19% from the previous year. Every category was up except for the five-day. And the five-day includes that Wednesday, which is only the preview day. It's very low attendance compared to the other days. But our every other category was up significantly, especially the four-day pass. By denomination, the one-day pass and the adult one-way are still the lion's share. That's what we're selling the most of throughout the Comic-Con. But people really appreciate the ability to buy the multi-day passes for this event that targets. Many of them are attending 3 and 4 days of the event. And that will conclude our presentation, and we would be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you for the excellent presentation. Are there any comments from my colleagues? Yes, Mr. Alvarez.
With the change in the passes, are these options going to continue for the Comic-Con type of event? I mean, that's probably the only large event in San Diego where we would consider doing 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 days. Or is that going to change with the change in the day passes?
We can continue to do marketing and promotional. It's part of the fair ordinance allows us to do that.
Okay, and so this compared to the cloud, what's the split? How many people buy the printed pass versus the cloud pass?
The cloud represented about 15% of all sales. So whether you're buying, I don't have the numbers for the printed tickets, but also the printed tickets and the TVM sales are representing 85% of the sales.
Okay, so people are still doing the printed tickets, which then probably puts a strain on the machines and the selling of the tickets.
Yep, we will continue to emphasize mobile.
And I do have those numbers. We sold about 14,000 units at our portable ticket booths. We sold about 80,000 units at the ticket vending machines. And then the cloud was 12,400. Wow. So the ticket vending machines are still carrying the bulk of the load, but they're at all 53 stations, and so we have people that are boarding all over the place. But the high profile stations where we have ticket sales and manual ticket sales, but we are restricted to cash only at those. So that anybody that's using a debit or credit card still has to go to the TVM. Or use the Compass card. And we do try and encourage people to use the Compass Cloud, phone app when we have direct communication with them to make it easier for them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for those questions. My only comment is, how can we do Comic-Con throughout the year so we can increase our ridership? It seems like that's the golden ticket there.
Well, yeah, I mean, we do a lot of work with the convention center because, you know, Comic-Con is the big one, but there's other conventions in town that bring, you know, between 10 and 20,000 people. We just had an inquiry yesterday for a 2019 show they want to buy 25,000 tickets. Mm. So we'll see if that works out.
Yeah, that's good. Ms. Brex, I see your lights.
Thank you. Rob, Tom, this is my favorite report of the whole year. I love the Comic-Con report. And as far as the ticket issue, those printed tickets are souvenirs, and they're almost, you know, it's a badge of representation. I don't think we'll ever get away from that at all. And the slide that you had on the ridership, one of the years when we had the zombie walk, my family participated, and we rode the Charlie Jet. I was dressed as a nun zombie. Huh. Got a lot of comments on that. It was scary, and I wanted to speak just a little bit to the safety issue as well, as I'm now dressed up as a nun zombie. I did fall down, and chivalry is not dead. I had many people trying to pick up this old decrepit nun zombie, but my hat is off to you guys. And I know, Rob, this is one of your favorites as well. So again, awesome work. Thank you.
Thank you for that incredible report, Rob. So we are going to move forward with the report on the MTS Free Ride Day. Turn it over to you, Rob.
Okay, so we had a lot of fun on Free Ride Day, too. Just to remind you of our goals, this was kind of a part of our Choose Transit campaign designed to start to reverse the downward ridership trends. We really wanted an event that gave other organizations, cities, the county, the Navy, major employers, the impetus to kind of join us in the call to action to Choose Transit. And then it's just our platform to kind of launch a broader campaign for people to consider the alternative of transit. Our tactics, and thanks to you, I mean, it was a successful event because of you around the table. We went to all the cities, we went to the county, and you all were very gracious and welcoming us and giving us a proclamation. Moreover, though, every city in the county also, we gave them a toolkit, and they were pushing out our messages. And so we reached, hundreds of thousands of people thanks to your participation. Really wanted to show that support by doing a media event prior to the day, and that was really successful. And then we wanted to be out in the stations and welcome our riders, not only new riders, but our existing riders, and show our appreciation. And that generated a bunch of media coverage on the day of the event as well. This is just a picture of all the proclamations that we received. That was great. The collaboration again. I mean, we went out, and the city of Chula Vista had our free ride day in their police department monitor. The Navy had our free ride day stuff and 70 monitors throughout San Diego County. 80 organizations were posting about the free ride day. We had posts from Todd Glorian, Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher, Scott Peters, Chris Ward, Barbara Bryan, Bree, and many more. Third-party Facebook posts were really prevalent, and retweets too. So we just got a lot of different people out there supporting the day and encouraging people to ride. I did spend some money to let people know that the free ride day was coming up. We did billboards. We had over 200 street banners throughout the various communities in our region. We put up street banners along our transit centers, did some TV advertising, print ads, radio, digital, and DMV also down in Chula Vista had our ads on there as well. Free Ride Day got a lot of boosts in terms of the impressions. So our earned media was over 3.5 million impressions, and our website traffic doubled. That's a picture of our news conference there. A lot of the participants in the news conference arrived to Old Town aboard the bus, and so that made a great visual of our participants getting off transit and then encouraging people to ride. It was a big team effort. Everybody in our organization was involved. Our ambassadors were out at all the stations. We had people from procurement and from finance and all of our departments out there in the system helping our riders and appreciating them. Our bus operators were tremendous, and they were fully behind it. I think one of the testaments to the outreach effort and to the advertising effort to let everybody know of the day was that we got very, very few complaints. The biggest one was people launched their Compass Cloud day passes before getting to the station, and then they realized it was free ride day. The magic of that is that we can push out a courtesy pass. So they did pay for their day, but they got another free day. We only got two complaints that this was unfair to the regular customers who had already bought that their fare. And our trip planning crew was really busy. They did over almost 1,100 trip plans that day. So here are the results. You've probably seen this chart, but we were up 17%. So we compared the ridership on October 2nd of this year to October 3rd of last year. So those are really similar days. You know, UCSD's back in session, so we decided the most accurate way to compare the ridership was to go back a full year. This is the breakdown. I mean, we were up in all categories. You can see that East County and the Green Line were kind of led in the percentage gain, but all told, we were up 52, almost 53,000 riders that day. So I think that's a measure of our success. We put together a little video to kind of capture the flavor of the day. And my last slide, I believe, is, you know, we can't let the momentum die. I think we created a lot of buzz around San Diego, but we've got to convert those riders into regular riders. And so we're going to continue with our Choose Transit campaign, working with the City of San Diego and others to really elevate our Transit Tuesdays activities. And we're beginning work with Civilian, which is our hired advertising firm, to do some buy one, get one passes along some targeted corridors. So that's our next steps.
Thank you for that. And the video was really exciting. Are there any comments from my colleagues? Yes. Vice Chair Rios.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really loved the video, and I had an opportunity to go out on Free Ride Day and talk to folks. And just the comment you made about, you know, of course we can't always please everybody all the time, but some of those who had pre-bought tickets, and I noticed when I was out at the stations, there were lots of posters, you know, in different areas about Free Ride Day. How far out did you start that?
Our campaign started about a month prior.
A month. Okay. Okay, that's great. Thanks so much again.
Thank you for that. Mr. Elfers.
Thanks for the presentation. Just curious on the cost side and the investment that went into this. Mm-hmm. Can you go over that?
So I think there are two ways to look at the cost. There's the direct cost that we put into it in the advertising, and you know, I don't have the breakdown of all of the categories there, but the total budget was about $125,000. The other component is the lost revenue that we would have got. We've got a lot of cash riders in our system. The estimates, you know, it depends on the day, but I think it was about $125,000 additional dollars that we did not receive. So the total investment might be said to be $250,000. The way I look at the return of investment on that is if we converted about a little less than 300, if 300 of those 52,000 people that rode become regular riders, we would get a return on investment. You know, 12 times 72 is 864, I think. Divide that into your 250,000, and it's about 290. So that conversion rate is about a half of 1%. So I think we can achieve that. And I think if I continue with our aggressive marketing, that we can convert a lot of those first-time riders into regular riders.
And do we collect any data, even like, I mean, how can we follow up with some of those people and try to be more aggressive about trying to convert?
Well, part of our effort too was to, at all of our outreach in the morning and afternoon, we did 12 outreach sessions where we were greeting riders both in the morning and afternoon commutes. And we collected email addresses and phone numbers. And so That goes into our Rider Insider database, and okay. So we've got, so that's a one way that we can continue to reach those people.
All right. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Ms. Ellis.
So since I saw one of my staff members in the video, is there a way we can get a copy of that? So
yes. She
can...
I think I saw you in that video, too.
Just for a flash. But, yeah, this particular staff member, she's been captured on a number of videos, so I think I better start acting as her agent now.
No, thank you once again for the great report. Yes.
Jump in with one quick question. I went to the back of our agenda packet to the transit glossary section, which is very helpful. Thank you, guys. I did not see BOGO, and if I missed that.
Yeah, it's buy one, get one.
Buy one, get one. Okay, like thank you very much. Uh-huh. I apologize if I missed it in your earlier comments.
Thank you. Once again, thank you for the great presentation. And yeah. We're trying to keep up with the acronyms, right? No, thank you once again. And I was very excited to have participated and look forward in continuing the campaign. So with that, we're going to move on to the budget operations status report.
Also known as everyone's second favorite presentation of the year. Not yet. So we're looking at the fiscal year results for 2018. These are preliminary at this time. We're still in the middle of our year-end audit. We're finalizing that, so these should be very close to final numbers. But it gives us a look at the entire year. We start on operating revenue and looking at operating revenue for the year. Fare revenue is unfavorable by about $400,000, 0.4%. As everyone knows, this has been an issue for a number of years now. And we did come very close to our lowered target, so that was fairly positive, and we did more than make up with that for other operating revenues. That was favorable by almost $2.1 million. Now, this is primarily in energy credits that we get from the state and from the federal government. These credits, there's two pieces to this. One is the rates on the state side have been growing rapidly, and they've exceeded numbers that we typically see for these credits, so we're able to generate a lot of more money in the second half of the year than we expected based on those rates. The other piece of this is when we did the mid-year amended budget, we took this number up by over $1 million, but we missed a piece, and it should have been a little bit higher based on what we had sold to date. So there was an underestimation in our mid-year budget was part of that as well. So in total, the energy credits came in at over $7.5 million, and it was about $1.6 million ahead of what we planned. So it's a very large number. We also had some other favorable experience within it, various pieces of administrative operating revenue that helped drive this variance towards the end of the year. So in total, we're $1.7 million favorable on operating revenue. It's a 1.6% favorable variance. On the expense side, we did end up $1 million unfavorable to budget, to the amended budget. It's 0.4% unfavorable variance. The large drivers there are in outside services, which was our security contract costs. We had some station stuff at our new stations that we didn't factor into the mid-year budget. So that was sort of a surprise as we rolled up the year-end numbers. And the other piece in there was risk management. We expected to be favorable overall in risk management as we were going through the mid-year budgeting process. But we did have some large settlements there at the end of the year that were unexpected that drove on an unfavorable variance there. And then we also were unfavorable in our materials line, where the revenue parts for vehicles, it's hard to predict that. So that ended up being slightly unfavorable as well. So those were the main drivers, and again, about $1 million unfavorable, 0.4%. At year end, we can also look at our subsidy revenues. Overall, subsidy revenues were favored by $1.4 million. There's a couple big moving pieces in here. One is STA. So our state transit assistant, we usually get projections for that from the state controller's office, and the actual number we received for the year was much higher than their projections, a $1.9 million favorable variance. Most of that is in our normal STA. Part of that is SB1 that was a little bit higher, but it really is the overall base of state transit assistance that grew over this last year that is driving that. And that's good because it'll roll over into this next year as well. And should we lose SB1, our overall base of STA is growing a little bit that offset a little bit. We did make a major adjustment on the downside to our Medi-Cal revenues. If you recall, for those who are around on the budget process last year, We kept the Medi-Cal revenues in the budget, even though there's some question about what's going on with that at the state level. Over the summer, we learned that that program has been eliminated at the state level, and that money is now going to the managed care providers that manage those beneficiaries to pay for those trips. Well, that process is still how we collect that money from the managed care providers for these trips we're still working on. But we decided not to accrue any revenue for all those periods going back a few quarters to make sure that we don't have any surprises going forward. So we do have a large unfavorable variance in Medi-Cal revenues versus what we budgeted because it doesn't look like we'll get any more reimbursement for that going forward. Now we do have that revenue in FY19 budget we'll need to address as well because it doesn't look like we'll receive that amount of funding for Medi-Cal as we have in the past. On the positive side, Transnet revenue came in favorable by about $1 million. Part of that is our normal sales tax receipt formula share. The other part of that is the reimbursement we receive for all of our BRT routes and our stations, BRT stations out there. That's security cost that was unfavorable on the expense side actually has ended up favorable on this because Sandag ultimately pays for those security costs at those stations. So those were positive variances on that side. So when I roll up the year for the operating budget, we were 1.7 favorable on operating revenues, 1 million unfavorable on operating expenses. So net operations produced about a $600,000 favorable variance, 0.4% favorable variance. And then subsidy revenues was favorable by 1.4 million, resulting in about a $2 million favorable variance overall. Again, these are preliminary. We'll bring this back with when we do the final comprehensive annual financial report next month and give you the real numbers. These should be very close, though. The last thing we typically look at is our ongoing concerns, the major drivers of some of our variances. Regional sales tax receipts ended up favorable for the year. Very slightly favorable, but that always a good sign for the next year because it's a compounding type thing. If you miss one, it makes the next year really hard to make. So if we make that one, we can always feel a little bit safer about next year. The state of California budget was very favorable, as we talked about. Our base state transit assistance funding is very strong. And a reminder on that is we have not programmed any SB1 revenues for FY19 at this point in time. So we will receive at least $4 million for July through October of SB1 that we will probably incorporate into our 2020 CIP. But if SB1 stays around, there's some other decisions to be made because none of that money has been included at this point in time. Passenger levels came in very close to budget, so hopefully we can see a bottom there and have some growth for FY19. And then on the energy side, our major concern is with electricity. We missed our budget number on electricity for May and June primarily, but July and August, we missed our budget by a lot. We have the spike that everyone saw on their home bills. We saw substantially, not only in our SDG&E costs, but in our commodity costs. So we have to watch that one very carefully. On the flip side, our compressed natural gas costs came in favorable last year. We expect those to continue to be favorable this year, so hopefully those two can offset each other in the coming year. So that completes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I'd like to just address the Medi-Cal issue that he talked about, because that's a big hit for us. And the legislation that was passed in 2016, I think, was a bill that was intended to help Medi-Cal patients get to non-emergency medical appointments and to the pharmacy and other medically related. In it, though, it didn't talk at all about any kind of reimbursements to transit operators or anything, because we as transit operators aren't really familiar with the Medi-Cal program and how they contract with these healthcare agencies. So it wasn't a red flag for us. Nobody in the state really knew what was going on about it until all of a sudden the county put out some notifications that, yes, this is in place now and you all now need to do something about it. And we, were all scratching our heads. Why wasn't the transit operators, why weren't they alerted to it? Well, nobody even in the legislature seemed to understand that this was the unintended consequence of what they were passing. So that having been said, we've already approached the author to try to get some cleanup legislation to help us in the future, because it's not just MTS, it's LA Metro. We were kind of on the forefront of getting reimbursed for these Medi-Cal trips. these other agencies were just about to come online doing that themselves, and so this kind of has us all in a waiting pattern. So it will be in our legislative program next year.
Thank you, Sharon. I was actually going to ask you to tell us more about that, so I appreciate that. Any comments or questions? I see none. Thank you for the excellent presentation, Mike. Next time, we want a video, shiny video. But thank you. I know that you're doing a great work, so thank you. The report from the Ad Hoc Ballot Measure Committee, Mr. Alvarez?
Yeah, I think staff is working on a meeting for October. We haven't had one since our last report at the last month's board meeting. We will make sure to notify interested folks to be a part of that meeting either late October or sometime in November, with the goal of having something before a meeting, definitely having a meeting before December. So we'll keep you all posted. Thank you.
I do not have a report either. Most of it has been shared throughout the day. Paul is hiking Peru. So with that, Sharon, do you have anything to share with us?
I guess I should say that we went to the American Public Transportation Association conference, learned quite a bit of new technology and a lot of really important things that are going to help us moving forward.
Yep.
If I can add to that, we learned how to talk to millennials too.
Yes. LIs, BOGO, and many acronyms. It was a great conference, and one of our board members, Mr. Ron Roberts, was recognized, received a very distinguished award, so and he represented us very well at the conference. With that, we do have an additional public request to address the board, Mr. Patrick Brown. He has left. Okay, so Patrick has left. So our next meeting is scheduled for November 8, 2018, and this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.